This week on a very special on taking pictures. No, I can't do it. No. I can't do it. Because I'll start giggling like an idiot.
Wait, you giggle?
Like an idiot. Hey kids, it's Tuesday, episode 108 of On Taking Pictures. 2 years and four now. Whew. Right?
Yeah. Telling you, there's some states that we're already married by now.
Well, I want the car. we're here each and every week talking about photography, talking about creativity, talking about all the gooey stuff that nobody else talks about because they're too busy talking about lenses and bodies and flashes and remote triggers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com, where you can check out the new F&B bookshelf. What do you think of that? You saw that, right?
I like it. I agree with many of the books.
It's pretty good. And with me, the agreeable and fancy. We're back to being fancy just for the week.
Okay, just for the
week. Let's see how it fits. Bill Wadman.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice out today.
Yeah.
It's cool.
It's beautiful out in New York City this last like 5 days. Like yeah, this is our perfect zone.
Mm. It's been hot and then yesterday was a little cooler. But it's good. It's good.
So that you notice that the weather affects your mood?
Yes.
Okay. Is that one of the advantages of living in sort of the quasi desert? Is that the weather doesn't change as much? Is generally sunny?
It's generally sunny, but it is noticeably hotter than when I was a kid.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
It's not just because you're remembering it differently?
I don't think so. It seems to be hotter sooner here now.
Okay.
And it stays hotter longer.
Okay.
There's a
term for that.
What is it?
Global warming.
Right, yeah. Right. Thanks, fossil
climate people. Change.
Yeah. the last week, I would say, it was really windy all week long.
Okay.
And it was, the wind usually comes out of the west here.
That kick up dust?
Week, yeah, tons.
Okay.
Last week it was coming out of the east and
Mary Poppins came.
We're talking about, 60, 80 mile an hour gusts.
Oh, okay.
It was really, really windy.
Yeah, you're in a wind tunnel.
Yeah,
in the valley
and
there.
There was a fire about 4 miles away from me that burned. I think it burned ultimately 1,200 acres, something like that. And there was a big fire going in San Diego. I mean, this is kind of...
It's the end of days right there.
Yeah, it's, I hate to use the term, but it is kind of fire season.
Sure.
And then, it'll hopefully rain. But the downside of that is then all the stuff that was burned by the rain, then it creates mudslides. So the people that live in, Palisades or Laguna or, something like that, they get hit twice, which is kind of a bummer.
Well, this is a very uplifting show we're doing today.
Right? So, in famine news...
this morning, we were going to do the show at our normal time, and I get a phone call from a friend of mine who's in from out of town and who's a saxophone player. My friend Mark Small is a serious sax player, was like the tenor player for Michael Bublé for years, plays on all kinds of Broadway shows, is, serious, serious guy. And he was in town in the neighborhood and he wanted to have breakfast. So we, put off the show for like an hour so I can go have a quick breakfast with him. And we got talking a little bit about the topic that we were going to talk about today, which is sort of this whole, what is the difference between craft and art, right?
Right.
And he thinks that art is when you take craft to the point where the people who do the craft realize that this is something special and different. So artful scrapbooking, to use the example, and if we throw that around today just as, an example of something, it's not to disparage scrapbookers. But like his point is that, the scrapbooking community can look and say, oh, well, that's really special because that is outside of our norm.
Right.
What I mean? And I thought that was kind of an interesting way of putting it. But, just to get us started on that, what do you think about this whole thing? What's your craft versus art distinction?
I go back and forth on this. I still like the idea of art being an external decision or label. I think too many people get caught up in making art.
Okay.
Or labeling what they are making as art.
Right.
And I don't think that for me, I don't think that should be for you to decide. I think that should be something that is not attached to it, but I guess applied to it afterwards. I would much rather be a craftsman
right.
than an artist.
Well, you know, two things. One, let's talk about I listened to an interview with Adam Savage, Mythbusters guy.
Yep.
Yesterday. And, you know, like they're all about craft, right? I mean, most of the stuff that they do, you would not call art the stuff that they're building, even like the props for movies and that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
Adam's all about being a craftsman. Now, some people would say, oh, he's an artist. Look at these things that he comes up with that he's building. He's, you know, making hands that are, you know, automated and actually work with motors and that kind of stuff for some TV show. Well, that's art at a certain level. I don't think he would ever call it that, right? He would always just say that he's really good at making stuff, you know?
Right.
And that is like craft. I think that a lot of the people who refer to their stuff as art or want to be seen as artists with quotes around it,
mm-hmm.
don't always do so because they actually believe that, but they do so because the public, the other people that they're trying to either sell their work to or show their work to, expect a certain level of confidence in
maybe.
You see what I'm saying? That like
yeah,
they don't
maybe.
Want the label, but the label has to be there for people to take them seriously.
Maybe. But I don't like the idea of art simply as a cachet.
Well, I don't think that most people who are artists do, who claim to be artists do either. I think that it's sort of a necessary evil that the market has put on it.
Maybe, but there was a guy called Sam Maloof. You ever okay. heard of Sam Maloof?
No.
Sam Maloof built chairs.
Okay.
Built, Google him real quick. M-A-L-O-O-F, yes. Sam Maloof. The most exquisite rocking chairs you've ever seen in your life.
Yep, beautiful.
And did it for years, had waiting lists for chairs that were many years long. His chairs sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, they were chairs.
Yep.
Just a chair.
Yeah.
But the craftsmanship with which he approached building these chairs was unmatched.
Sure. Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, it's also, is there a difference between art and craft in the sense that craft is making something that's useful in a sort of a tangible set in a tangible way, where somebody who's making art is sort of art for, I'm making stuff for the sake of making it, not that it's useful for anything else. Where this guy, at the end of the day, you could sit in his chairs.
You could, sure. Or there are any number of amazing ceramicists and potters that
yeah, ultimately
that make,
you could eat out of that, you know.
You could.
Yeah.
They make both usable and decorative work.
Sure.
Art has, I think, by and large, been usurped by the 1%.
Yes. The label and, or art in general?
Both.
Has it ever been different?
I think yes.
Okay.
You know, Picasso talks about when he, before he was Picasso, you know, sort of capital P, and you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
You know what I mean?
Capital P Picasso.
Capital
I like that.
P Picasso. When he was just, you know, sort of Pablo making pictures, he sold. It was more important to sell, to move the work, get the work out of the studio.
Sure.
And he says, you know, I didn't always sell things for a lot of money. You know, I sold them because that's what I wanted to do to make a living. That's what I insisted that I had to do.
Sure, but how many normal people do you know who have middle class lives making, you know, whatever the average is, $50,000 a year in America? Do you know who actually buy art? I mean, is that an education thing?
Now it's a money thing.
And we'll think people in 1950s did? See, I don't know that it's ever been different. I think it's always been the rich people who buy art because they have nothing else to do with their money.
It depends on what you're defining as art. Is an original painting art, or is an original painting that's only perceived as good, worthful, you know, important, valuable, whatever you want to ascribe to it, is that art? Because you can buy original paintings for not a lot of money. I mean, look at the three chimp paintings behind Seth Godin in your portrait that you did at his studio.
Yep.
Okay. Those are kind of I wouldn't call them a meme, but they become very popular.
Yep.
Yeah. And they're these sort of Chinese knockoffs that you can order on eBay.
But he bought them because he liked the fact that there were mistakes in there on purpose.
Okay.
That's why he wanted them because they had a kitsch. But
whatever.
No, sure. My mother bought a painting down in the Cayman Islands when they were down there getting married, apparently, because we saw it last weekend when we were up there. And it's, you know, I personally would not have bought the painting that she bought. I don't see anything in it. But I guess that my mother does, you know. Or maybe she doesn't know any better. I don't know.
I think there are too many people that look at the signature first.
Sure.
When buying a piece of art.
Oh, I have friends who own Picassos and Cezannes and things, you know, like people I know. And it's, you know, you go to your house and people are looking for the signature down in the corner because that's just, it's a status thing, right?
Right.
But art's always been a status thing. Why do you think the, you know, church paid so much money to have beautiful paintings and sculptures and all that?
Sure,
you know?
Sure. But I think craft has in many ways gotten the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
Using the scrapbooking example, the process of scrapbooking and the process of Rauschenberg or Shepard Fairey or Cy Twombly or, you know, any number of other people, the process is virtually identical.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of assemblages and collage. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
But one is, you know, relegated to your local Michaels and the other hangs in MoMA.
Yep. Because it's got an eagle on it.
Maybe. You know, at some point, and I think this is changing, but at some point, craft went out of fashion in favor of art.
Yeah. Hey, look, my favorite book of all time is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right? Which is all about, the whole premise of the book is that certain things have quality, certain acts that you things that you make, certain the things that you do, and they have an inherent quality because of sort of the intention of making them and them having a certain level. But that is all about, you know, there's a story that he tells in there of how his friend who had this fancy BMW motorcycle, that his handlebars were slipping because he couldn't tighten it enough, like they had compressed a little bit. And so basically they needed a shim to put in there to open it up a little bit so they could tighten it. And the guy was like, oh my God, I got it. And he went and cut a beer can, like basically beer can into a strip, like cut the outside around.
Right.
And like pulled the label off and cleaned it up and stuck it in there and put it in there. And the guy was like, you can't put a beer can in my BMW motorcycle. And because he was offended by the fact that like, oh, you can't put it in my fancy German motorcycle.
Right.
And the narrator's just like, you know, when you really think about it, like this is an ideal solution to the problem. It's a metal that doesn't oxidize. It's you know what I mean? Like
it's handy.
It's cheap. It's perfect. It's malleable. It's, you know, all of these things that any German engineer who's in the room would say that's a genius solution to the problem and therefore has quality. You know what I mean?
Right.
But the guy was upset because it didn't look good. You know what I mean? In his head in some kind of weird way. And I think that it's, you know, we talk a lot on this show about all this stuff having to do with, you know, thinking about it and thinking about it. And then, you know, we talk about doing it as if, are they two sides of the same coin, or are they, is thinking about it and doing it two separate acts?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, is the thinking about it I'm sort of going to negate 107 episodes, worth it, or is it a waste of time?
If the thinking about it, if that's where it ends, then yeah, go do something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, we talked a little bit before the show. I just read David Duchovny's new book.
Sure.
Which, comes out June 6th, 5th, 8th, something like that. Anyway, it's called A Beautiful Anarchy. And for those of you who have read any of David's work, he's a big proponent of vision, of finding your vision, of cultivating, refining, etc. And that's kind of been his thing for several books, you know, since Within the Frame came out. And while I love his writing, and he's, in fact, the way he turns a phrase is, I've said this several times, it's like fuel to me. Mm-hmm. But in this book, he's not talking about vision. He's talking about creativity. He's talking about, let's not worry so much about making art, but let's worry about making the artist. Mm-hmm. Because if you make the artist, the art will come almost as a byproduct of being an artist, whatever that means to you.
Yeah.
And I think we can insert, I think David would be okay with inserting craftsman, interchanging those words.
Sure.
But he's very clear about the thinking versus the doing. And in fact, says so much, you know, or writes rather. He writes, I don't believe coming up with great ideas is the same as being creative. Being creative is about creating. It's about doing.
Yep.
And so too is living, because life is an act of creation.
Right. Like all the best laid plans don't mean anything if you didn't actually act on them.
Right. Well, and you know, talking about it, we talked about our Seth Godin. His thing is, if you don't ship it, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
You're not in the game unless you ship.
Yep. I agree.
You know, yeah. My friend, Father Bill Moore is the same way with art. He is out painting every day because, and what's more, the end result or the end step of art is to give it, loan it, sell it to another human being. Get it out of your studio, get it out of your life. The goal of it is to get it out into the world so that others may enjoy it.
Yep.
Yeah. Your job was to create it, not to fawn over it.
Right.
Your job was to give birth to this thing, whatever this thing is, not to treat it so preciously after it's been created. Once it's been created, get it out into the world.
Yeah. You know, this last couple weeks, and especially this last week, like I started doing these silly 90 degree rotation things last week.
Right.
Which was just an idea that I had that I wanted to see if I could do, and it worked. And then I did another one, and actually have a few more lined up. So like, okay, I have that going on. And a couple people wrote me after seeing them and say, oh, I want to do one of those. And it's like, okay, sure. Now, so I'm lining people up.
You should call the series, It's Crunch Time.
It's actually really hard. You know, it's funny when if you're lying on your back and you're trying to look, you kind of forget about gravity. If you're just sort of living your life normally,
yeah,
you know,
well, you
forget.
Everybody ends up looking like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
you
but
you're like,
it's amazing how it pulls, even when you're sitting down, it's like there's nothing holding my butt onto the apple box.
Right.
So I have to physically kind of figure out ways to push down so that my butt's actually on the apple box. It's just the things that you don't really think about. But I did that. And then on Saturday I had a shoot at the diner with six people involved. All showed up at like midnight and we, you know, took pictures for an hour. I'm reminded and excited about, I have like four different things going on right now that I've actually started and am doing, you know, and it's so much more satisfying to me to sort of have boots on the ground, as it were. you know, there's a book called Shop Class is Soulcraft. You ever read that mm-hmm. one?
No.
Basically, the guy's arguing that we've lost something in the fact that we have no connection to the material world for most of our work. You know,
right.
Basically, it's sort of an anti-computer thing, but not really. He's just saying, you know, that it's okay that like everyone being a knowledge worker is a bad thing, that like manual labor has intrinsic satisfaction and cognitive challenges.
And absolutely.
And it's I think that that's almost a better way of putting what we mean when we say craft, you and I, you know what I mean? That the act of doing in itself has something inherently good about it. You know, the act of moving your body in a certain way, the act of actually pressing that button, the act of, you know,
yeah, I agree. Yeah. Whatever it is, whether you're, you know, to use what you said, a knowledge worker, but at the end of that, you press print,
right?
Or you are, you know, a filmmaker working in digital, but then whatever it is,
yep.
Whatever it is, as long as there is an end game, an end result, something that you can ship.
Yep.
I think that's important. And I'm just as guilty of this as anybody else, maybe even more so, because I spend so much time just thinking about things.
You do? I hadn't noticed.
and I get bogged down in the theoretical side of everything. I will play out any scenario to, you know, the nth degree before I take action on it. It's something I've always done, and it's something I'm trying to be more diligent about working through.
What's the excuse in your head? What is your reasoning, if you catch my drift? You know, because there's part of you that knows that it's not wasteful, but like inefficient.
It is inefficient, but and the inefficiency argument battles with the failure argument.
Yeah, like if I didn't think about it enough and I fail, it means I didn't think about it enough, so I should
right.
think about it more next time.
There, I missed a T that should have been crossed.
Right.
But, you know, there was a...
But, of course, you know rationally that nothing is that minute.
No, nothing. and you're never going to catch them all.
Right. That you know? You're going to fail all the time. Everyone
yeah,
is.
Yeah. I you know, in reading through... David's book, there was a typo.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told him about it and he said, you know what, no matter how many people look at it, no matter how many times we read through it, it seems like we always catch something.
Yep.
You know, we'll make a note of it for the second edition.
Yep.
And it was like, there was no,
he didn't seem upset about it.
No, there was no, you know, conflict about it. It was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. But he's also been doing this long enough that he knows that happens.
Right. Right. Whereas I still get stuck in the what if, what if, what if,
right.
what if, what if,
but
what if,
he's
what
published
if, what if.
A dozen books in the time that you've been thinking about it or whatever.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yes. You know, I'm stuck in an if else loop and he's already, you know, hit the save and print buttons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that in and of itself is inspiring. This latest book, A Beautiful Anarchy, is, you know, wickedly inspiring for me in terms of getting out of my own way.
Do you get stuck in that place where you don't want to sully what you think is a virginal idea? This idea
yeah.
is so good, I don't want to do it because if I do it, it's not going to be as good as what is in my head.
Right. So you end up not doing anything.
Right, right, right.
You know,
see,
what have I done just in, you know, If I'm relegating this to just kind of me for a second,
yep.
Just in the last, let's say, week, I've put up the bookshelf.
Yep.
I've shipped the OTP t-shirt design to the printer.
Yeah,
to make sure it's okay.
Where was the reversal on that? You were 2 weeks ago. You were like, no t-shirt, and all of a sudden you decided to make a t-shirt
out of the blue.
Okay.
Because,
I like it. I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Okay. It kind of fits with what we're talking about. I was looking for the idea or the way to express the show or us or what we talk. And there is no the. There is just a.
Right.
Because you know, if I sat down to do another one tomorrow, I'd do something different. If you did one, you would do something different. If any of our listeners took a stab at it, they would do something different. But you know what? As of yesterday, I shipped.
Yep. Done. Moving on.
As of the day before, I shipped the bookshelf. As of the 5th of June, the new show ships. Right. As you know, so I am trying to move myself into taking thought, moving that into craft, and letting the world decide, or at least, you know, the small corner of my peers, whether or not it's art, it's notable, it's important, it's not, it doesn't matter to me. All I can do is control when I start and when I ship. So that's all I can control.
Is craft another word for action?
I think craft is a level of action.
Hmm.
Because you can, look, was there craft in this t-shirt? No, not really. I mean, I guess there was. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I it was me sitting in Illustrator for a couple hours.
Right.
Is that craft? Well, I guess if you don't know how to use Illustrator, it is. So, and it's relative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Could I go out and make, you know, a Sam Maloof chair? No, not on my best day. But when I was working as a prop maker at Alabama Shakespeare Festival, I had my boss, who was the head of the prop department, a guy by the name of Charles, for the first, gosh, I don't even remember how long, but for the first little while when I got there, wouldn't allow the use of power tools.
Right.
Had to use draw knives and spoke shaves and
your fingernails.
No, he said you need to learn a respect for the material before you can go tearing it apart.
Right.
And that I remembered that, and I value that approach of respecting what you do enough to give it the time that it deserves. Where I get stuck is putting a limit on how much time things deserve.
You know what else, too? I think that there is a importance put on the results versus what you learned doing. You know, like you learn far more doing and failing or succeeding. You learn far more doing than you ever do thinking about it.
Yes.
Or reading about it or talking about it.
Yep.
And you know, like I had this shoot on Saturday and, you know, and I'm dealing with 5 people on set and trying to think about all them and also thinking about all the technical aspects and whatnot, you know? And in the end, you know, the next day I'm like working on the pictures and I was like, oh, if I had to do over again, I would have done X differently and I do Y differently. It's like, well, I wouldn't have figured those things out until I went and did it and failed in some small way. Like, I'm still happy with the results, but you know what I mean? Like that right. Things were perfect. And it's like, well, I don't know that they'd ever be perfect, but I could make them better than this next time. And that's the whole point.
Right.
Is that
at some point
the next one's going to be better.
Yeah. You got to quit running the simulation and get out in the world and do it.
Yeah.
You know, I learned more about photography my junior, senior years in high school, spending all my time in my darkroom than I have since.
Right.
Because I was buying, you know, Tri-X in 100-foot rolls and I was burning through it. My friend Mark and I were bulk loading our own film and we were burning through it like it was nothing because at the time it was nothing.
I don't want to hear about your drug use.
you could buy a 100-foot roll of film for not a lot of money. Yeah. You know, chemicals were cheap.
Yeah.
And
back in the good old days.
Yeah.
When chemicals were cheap and men were men.
Yeah. You know, but had I just thought about all of that, I wouldn't have learned anything. It was doing it. It was doing photograms. It was doing pinhole.
I think you have to at a certain point, I don't know, forget that you're even trying. Does that make sense? That like it's
maybe, I mean,
it's sort of the flow thing. It's like you're so busy doing it that you're not even thinking about the fact that you're doing something. You know.
Well, the genesis of this, or at least one of the reasons we're talking about this, is this email that we haven't really even addressed yet.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to get to that.
and there are some good nuggets in here. There are some really good bits.
All right, what do you got? Who's this from?
This is from Paul Bunyer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's talking about his father. And he writes, he was a blue-collar worker during the regular work week, but a stone sculptor at nights and on weekends. First of all, respect for making things out of rock. That's that's amazing. He was a high school graduate and never went to college and never took an art class in his life. But he was an intellectual, and he studied whenever he was interested in whenever...
Whenever he was interested in it,
right. His studies included many things from human biology to photography and included aesthetics. In fact, I still have one of his copies of Santayana's The Sense of Beauty. Dad always said, and this is the great thing, Dad always said, craft is the doing, art is the feeling. Yep. I love that quote. I've searched to see if he was quoting Santayana or someone else, though I have found no such quote. I can see how he derived this thought from his studies. And it's a thought I go back to from time to time to reawaken my work in graphic design. I think this is on to something that I think craft and art can coexist. I don't think one needs to be a pejorative term for the other.
Right. Okay.
And there is something that I like quite a bit about this quote, Paul. So thank you for sending it in. There is something about getting it out the door. Yep. And I have been stymied for years in getting things out the door, you know, and it's only been in the last several months that I've made enough of a turn to start. And maybe it's the reading that I'm doing. Maybe it's the people that I'm talking to. Maybe it's just that I'm ready to do this. I don't know.
Yeah.
You've gotten stuck. What unsticks you?
It's funny that about 10 years ago, almost, well, 9.5 years ago to today, essentially, November 23rd, 2004 was
a day that will live in infamy.
Well, you know what? Funny enough, in my life. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the sense that was the day that I sat there and I said, you know, I do all these things. I write music and I take pictures and I blah, blah, blah. But how often do I actually do them? I say that I do them, but how often do I do them? And that's the day that I got out my keyboard and my stuff and I started my first daily project, right? And that led to a bigger weekly project the next year. And then that led to 365 portraits the next year. And that led to Drabbles and Motion and blah, 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 blah over the next years. But in some ways, it's like my output has slowed down as the things that I'm trying to output have become more complex. Just because, you know, it's like it's harder to do. But lately, in the last few weeks, I've had sort of this reawakening where I'm ready to start that cycle over again and do.
You're ready to sort of recapture that inertia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost just like it's like I had a push 10 years ago and I coasted on that push for 5 or 6 years.
Yes.
And then I've been a little slow for a while and now I'm like ready for another push.
Yeah.
And it feels good. It's sort of like getting out there and taking a jog, like first thing in the spring. Well, you don't know what that's like because you live in a place where there is no spring. But you know what I'm saying. You get my drift, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm right there with you. The last little while now of actually getting things out the door, you leaves me with, what the hell have I been doing? Why haven't I been doing this?
Yeah.
Because the other thing is I write a lot more and it's, and I'm not writing, you know, this amazing prose. I'm just getting things out of my head. You know, I carry these field note journals with me wherever I go and I'm always writing things down or I've got, on my phone, I've got this app called Daedalus, which is fantastic because it syncs up with Ulysses in the cloud. So anything that I write on my phone or on my iPad is also on my Mac immediately. So everything is always connected, right?
Yep.
And I'm writing things down, if for nothing else, A, to record them, but B, to get them out of my thought process so I can move on to something else.
That's a very GTD thing, the getting things done.
Okay, I was going to...
The whole
who is GTD?
Like, get it out of your brain so that it's on a... You know, make it turn... Put it on paper so that you don't have to carry it around anymore.
Right. And it's helping immensely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I think that you and I both, though, have, we both struggle from, not like just that sort of cyclical depression thing. And that could be part of it.
I do.
So,
and I have since I was a kid.
Right. So
now I must say, and I don't know if you were like this when you were younger, but my swings are much less dramatic and much further apart than they were when I was in my 20s.
Yeah. Lower in frequency and lower in amplitude.
Yeah. Is that common with you? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, right. I'm mellower, but they're also harder to get out of.
Well, that's the thing is if you take a sine wave and squish it together, you've got one look at a wave. But if you pull that apart, now those ebbs and flows, yes, they're further apart, but they also last longer when you're in them.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, but I think coming to terms with all kinds of things in my life have allowed me to now let go of that stuff more easily. And I don't know if that's a temporary thing that I'm dealing with right now or mm-hmm. or some sort of turning a corner in my life. And I don't know if it's because I'm 39 and getting older. You know what I mean? I don't know. It could be any number of things. But it's like I'm not as scared. I've realized that I've gotten caught up for way too long on trying to make stuff that appeals to other people or trying to make stuff in such a way that I can then market it, like sort of take, and there are people I know who do this very successfully.
Sure.
And I've taken it on as sort of like, oh, they're being successful doing this, so I'm going to try doing that. And it's never worked for me. And I've realized that why do I do this? I don't do this. Yes, I like making a living doing this, and I'd love to make more money doing this. Who wouldn't? You know, that whole thing. But that's not why I do it. I do it because I enjoy doing it. It makes me happy, you know? And so really what I should just do is just do what makes me happy. And because anything else, I'm kidding myself. I'm like playing a game, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is somehow very freeing.
It is. And I agree with you. And it's again, it's something that I've kind of come to grips with. I have control over when I start and when I ship, and everything in between or everything on either side of that, I have to kind of give up on. I have to stop trying to control it. There's a great quote, and I'm going to butcher it, but it's in David's new book. And it's something to the effect of, what I control is how deeply I live, not how long.
Yes.
You know, I love that idea that I control how much passion I live with. I don't know how long I've got, but I do know that today I'm going to do something, whatever that something is.
There's a great quote that Adam Savage brought up in that interview. Because, you know, he's an atheist, so he doesn't believe in any like religious implications of life and death and whatnot. But he apparently likes this. This guy came and said, you know, that the life and death is, it's an eagle that gives you life and an eagle that takes it away from you. Right. Just comes heartless, just comes and kills you right at mm-hmm. the end, whenever it wants to, whenever it decides that it's time for you to go. And your life, your reason for being here, the meaning all of it is meaningless in the larger scale. Like it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter to the eagle.
Right.
Yeah.
For the scale of time, it doesn't matter. You don't matter. You know?
Your life doesn't matter to the eagle.
Right. The only thing you can do is make the meal better for the eagle by living an expansive life. Like expanding your mind while you're alive. Sure. Gives the eagle a better meal. So you might as well do that.
Sure.
And he put it better than that, but it was just really an interesting idea that like, it doesn't matter. And so some people would get nihilistic and say, well, then why do I do anything? I might as well sit around, eat Cheetos and watch Breaking Bad while doing meth. And
I love the addition there. Well, yeah. While doing
if
that.
You're watching Breaking Bad, you might as well. But there's this sense that it's just like, well, why have all these things if it doesn't really matter in the end? Well, it doesn't matter, but you know what? You might as well do it because why not? You know what I mean? Like, while you're here, have an enriching life in some way, however you define that.
Can you find this thing and maybe put it in the show notes?
Yeah, I'll find it. Well, okay. Definitely the interview is easy because it's one of the what's it called things, the chat show.
Oh, the Pollock. Kevin Pollock.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So what happens? And we got another interesting email, and this kind of fits, right?
Yep.
And we'll not mention names on this one, but this was a pretty powerful email.
Yes,
would
it
you,
was.
Would you
no,
agree?
Absolutely. Sorry. Yeah, absolutely.
So what happens when how can we do this with?
Well, I think this one had a lot to do with like relationships, right?
Right.
We had a listener wrote in and was talking about the fact that he really likes making portraits, but that he thinks he has to give it up because the one place that he does do it is apparently in his living room. He uses his living room as a studio because it's the only place that really works for him.
Right.
And apparently his wife hates it for whatever reason. So he's decided to just sort of...
And very, very definite. He's very definite about her feelings about it. He writes, merely tolerates paying shoots and non-paying ones cause fights. So there's a value thing there.
Yeah.
Where if what you're doing isn't paying the bills, then it has no value.
Yeah. There's definitely that there. Yeah. Which, you know, look, you and I are both going to come at this with some sort of personal value system in here, which may or may not be what this guy and his wife are thinking. So let's just put that out there saying, you know what I mean?
We might be
completely wrong about this situation. We don't know. Right.
But I mean, he seems to have, you know, he says, I never wished to be a full-time photographer, but I do want to be damn good. So there is this thirst or hunger for craft.
Yeah, and he says that making a good portrait is the most rewarding form of photography for him.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is his spouse. You know, I used to date this girl who was much less. She was great about my photography, except if it involved attractive women.
Okay.
And if I went on a shoot and I took pictures of some beautiful girl, and I came back and I showed them to her because I was proud of how the pictures came out. You know, instead of, wow, those look really good, she'd say, oh, you like that girl more than you like me. You think she's more beautiful. Like, you know, all those kinds of insecurity kind of things.
I don't get that that's the case here.
No, I don't necessarily think that that's true either. I'm just saying that I'm using this as an example.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized after that relationship ended and my current relationship later, where, you know, I'll go shoot nudes of people and do all kinds of things. And she's like, yeah, have fun. You know, that there's sort of an understanding that this is what I enjoy doing. And if there's some sort of problem with that, if my relationship causes a problem for the thing that I love to do, that was a big problem for me.
Right.
You know, to the point where it was like, this is untenable. Like, I just, you know what I mean? I'm not going to sit here and be miserable because you don't agree with what I like to enjoy doing, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, now in this case, there is apparently a much
bigger problems.
There's a bigger issue, not just with a spouse, but there are some family dynamics that are going on that are very unfortunate and I would imagine weigh enormously on both of them.
Yeah. I mean, you and I, you know, we just spent the last 45 minutes talking about basically ourselves getting in the way of us doing stuff.
Right.
this guy is saying it's somebody else who's getting in the way of me doing stuff.
Well, and beyond that, another influencer, effector, stressor, yeah, that is very real and is something that, that I don't think you and I, well, maybe you can, but I can't relate to it.
Right. Yeah. 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 Armchair psychologist thing just for half a second.
Yeah.
Maybe this has a lot more to do with that external factor than it does really his photography, mm-hmm, in mm-hmm, some way. I don't know, you know, like stresses of all that kind of stuff. So,
but couldn't the photography be seen as a coping mechanism of sorts?
No, I was going to say that. And
yeah,
here's the thing though, about all this kind of stuff. I think this is one example, but we have other people who have written in and said, you know, I love doing my photography and that kind of stuff, but you know, I have a wife and kids, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. And like, these are things that are keeping me from doing it, or it wouldn't stop me from doing it, but my partner, for whatever reason, says I can't, mm-hmm, or thinks that this isn't important enough, mm-hmm, you know? Those are really difficult things, because who's to say that anybody else can say what's important to you, you know?
Right.
And I mean, these are larger value judgments and that kind of thing. And people have different opinions about what is important in life, I guess.
Right.
This would be a very difficult situation for me, because I get a lot of my happiness out of what I do, you know? And if somebody said you couldn't do that if you wanted to be with me or whatever, I would have a really hard time with that.
Right. Because that is kind of core to who you have become, or who you are at this point in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You know, like if Conrad suddenly said, I need you to go become a banker instead of being a photographer, it'd be like, wow, that's, I don't know if I can make that. You know what I mean? Like that's tough. Now, luckily she would never do that, because that's just not who she is. And that's one of the reasons I love her, is that, you know, we have this relationship that is very supportive in those ways. Obstacles outside of the creative vision problem.
Yeah.
That's the big question, right? You know, we all love taking pictures, or else we wouldn't be listening to the show. We all love thinking about this stuff, or we wouldn't be listening to the show.
Right.
But I don't know. What were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I read over this email probably half a dozen times.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, not just the photography portion of it, but just sort of the hand that he's been dealt.
Sure.
Is so incredibly difficult.
Well, I mean, one of the things he says here is that, you know, not doing portraiture probably isn't as big of a deal as it feels like it is at the moment, considering all these other things these people are dealing with.
Right.
He says, I guess obstacles like these are what make the difference between the average and the great ones. You know, is overcoming adversity or obstacles one of the hallmarks of being great at something?
Well,
now, go ahead.
Is it? Well, it depends on who you're talking about.
Yeah.
If it's your personal perception, you know.
Yep.
Or is it the perception of other people who think you're great? When, yeah. I mean, we've talked about several photographers who are very popular, get paid a lot of money.
Sure.
And who really aren't very good.
Right. Sure.
And maybe rapists, you know? So I think the overcoming of adversity is part of it, but.
Well, I mean, you could argue, and this is certainly not on the same.
And I'm not laughing.
No,
believe me, I'm not laughing at the rapist comment.
I don't think anybody really took it as that. But
I'm laughing that you know.
One could argue, and I'm not saying these are apples. It's complete apples to oranges comparison.
Sure,
but you know, you and I spent the 45 minutes talking about this depression stuff, right?
Yeah,
it could be that for us the obstacle is the depression. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the obstacle we have to get over. But that doesn't mean that there is no such thing as an obstacle that is actually insurmountable within certain.
No, not at all.
There are some things that just, you know, if you no longer have the use of your legs and arms for some terrible, like you're a quadriplegic, you're not going to be, you know, doing landscape photography where you have to hike to the cliff. You know what I mean? Like there are limitations to things that you cannot overcome. I mean, I guess you could have somebody bring you there. You understand what I'm saying?
But while overcoming that obstacle might be a great story in and of itself, it doesn't mean the resulting work is going to be good.
Or better.
Right.
But here's but I mean, this all comes down to there are obstacles that get in your way that you have no control over. I mean, in a situation like this where somebody else says, I think what you're doing is a waste of time, or, you know, this makes me really upset because of this reason, or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
There has to be, I mean, the armchair psychologist version of me says, you know what, you guys have to sit down and discuss some sort of plan that allows this. You know what, for 3 hours in the afternoon on Sunday, I'm going to do my thing in here because that makes me happy. And you can go do whatever it is that you makes you happy for those 3 hours. You know what I'm saying? Some sort of shared thing.
Yeah. Or maybe it allows me to unplug from this for a minute so that I can come back to it 100%.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, the pressure cooker, a little bit of you know, the little bit of the pressure gets relieved through the course of the cooking.
Yeah.
Otherwise the thing explodes.
Yeah. You need a relief valve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think everybody needs a relief valve. I do that with heroin. No, I'm not. You know what's never a good idea, Jeffrey?
Heroin. Ever. Yeah.
We all have our things, right? Like I go rowing, you know, maybe it's exercise. For a lot of people, the creative stuff is their relief valve.
Right.
So absolutely. Like if this is like a mental health issue as much as it is just a hobby for some people, you know,
it's my tough. Heart goes out to you. It really does. And you know who you are, and thank you for feeling like you could share this, because this is a tough one.
Really tough.
Yeah.
We have a lot of listeners who are going through, who I think that we help get through some pretty heavy stuff.
I hope so.
Which is, we're very proud of.
I hope so.
You know, friends of mine were over for dinner the other night, and we got talking about somebody was taking a picture of one of them on the subway or something.
Right.
And they said if they saw somebody about to take a picture of them, they'd say something or stop them. And his wife said the same thing.
That they would stop them.
Yeah. And I was like,
okay.
And I was like, really?
There's something on, there was a discussion on the group about this.
There was. Okay. I missed it.
I think it was, I want to say it was Christopher Matheson. I think it was Chris that posted. Yeah, it was, posted a photo of, you know, he does a lot of street stuff in Japan.
Yeah.
And he's fantastic. If you haven't seen Christopher's work, go check it out.
What's in Japan?
What's in Japan?
Godzilla.
Gazira! Yeah. he caught somebody. It looks like the guy is kind of, he's not really making a funny face. He's kind of caught him like licking his lips mid-lick.
Yep.
Okay. And actually asked the question, you know, how do you guys feel about making sort of candid, not really portraits, but candid shots of people? Yep. In not necessarily embarrassing positions, but making funny expressions.
There has to be something novel about it, or else it's not interesting.
Right.
Right.
Now, some people think that you should ask for permission. Some people think you shouldn't. But I would argue that some of the best photographs, not just street photographs, but some of the most memorable or engaging photographs of people have been taken either from the hip or you know, without their knowledge or just in the instant that they look up and catch you looking at them with a camera.
Does art and your argument though, and my argument tends to be art trumps privacy in public.
To an extent.
Yeah.
To an extent.
That people have to be able to record society as it is for the posterity of society. There's an argument that I make.
Yeah, maybe. I think for me...
We need to know what it was like in 2014, and we do that by taking candid shots of people, not by everything being posed.
Right. I think it still comes down to intent. If your intent is to sensationalize or you know, intentionally paint somebody in a bad light or do something that's sort of exploitational... I might take umbrage with that.
Right.
But, you know...
Well, you know, it's...
somebody yawning or you know...
Yeah.
Mid-lick, as this guy is, I don't have a problem with it. You know, because,
I rewatched that documentary about Shelby Lee Adams the other day.
Okay.
Remember that guy, the Appalachian guy?
Yep.
Somebody sent us a link to it a while back, or maybe a Twitter link. And we had watched it, whatever, episode 10 or whatever the heck it was back in the day.
Right.
When we talked about exploitation a lot. We called them the exploitation episodes. Yeah. And I rewatched that. And those people, a lot of those photographs are not at all flattering, right? But those people were okay with them. Because they didn't see him as trying to make them look bad. He was just recording them as they are, and he was one of them because he grew up in the area and
right.
whatever the reasons were, right?
Again, it came down, in that instance, it came down to right. intent, I think.
And I think part of the other thing is that the people who were over, our friends who were over, they're New Yorkers. They're in 2014. They're city dwellers of a certain, you know, one of them went to Harvard. The other one, you know, they're at a certain level of all
right.
of that,
right.
that, and you know, and I, if I see somebody taking a picture, I was on the subway once and this kid was, he had like a 14 millimeter lens, had the camera like at his belt and had a quick release that I could see kind of went over into his pocket.
Like so, a cable release type thing?
Yeah. Something like yeah. that. Right. And I think it was electronic one, but you understand the point.
Yeah.
So that he could sit there and just sort of turn his body and not even look and take wide-angled shots of people on the subway. Now, 95% of people, 98% of people would never notice that he was doing this because he was doing it pretty slickly. But, you know, I know what he's doing, so I noticed it. I'm almost okay with that. And I don't know if it's like a weird age thing for me. No, I've probably always been fine, but I'm fine with it for different reasons now. Now it's sort of a, what is he going to see that I would be so upsetting? You know what I mean? Like me,
I guess I would take issue with it just because I don't.
But guys have been doing this, putting cameras in boxes and going on the subway since time immemorial.
Yes, they have, but I think that you should be in visual control over what you're making the image of.
Oh, you're saying, yeah, but like, you know, who was it?
But I guess with
was
a 14
Walker Evans who did the camera in the box or whatever it is.
Yeah. With a 14 mil, you're getting everything anyway.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, but my point is that like, I'm okay. I'm willing to understand that I am a member of a society and that the society deserves some level of, I don't know, like giving up a little bit of personal rights to be able to allow society to create art. Does that make sense?
Is a lot of this stuff art? That's we get.
I don't know. I don't know what
full
this
circle.
Who knows what this guy's making? But he's making something.
Yeah.
You know, there's this whole thing going on with Google and the EU. Did you see this whole thing where they've made things where now Google has to remove things from search results if somebody argues that it's no longer relevant? Or you know, you see this whole article?
Right.
And it's like, okay, first of all, that's you don't really understand how the internet works if you think that that's what's going on. But whatever.
I'm less concerned with that than I am with goofballs wandering around with Google Glass on all day long.
Oh, okay. Why? Do you think they're like recording something? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Just
why does that bother you?
It's just because not everything needs to be recorded.
Oh, okay. That's fair. I there's just part of me that's just sort of like, you know what? There's something embarrassing you did in college 15 years ago. There's a picture on the internet and you want Google to take it out of its index. Well, you know what? You actually did do that. And this is a record of everything. And we can trust it because it is a record of everything. The minute you start removing stuff, then it's a whitewashed version of everything, in which case we don't know what's real and what's not. You know what I mean? So in some ways, it's like having people be able to take pictures and not get super upset about it. I don't know. It's like, is this really something worth getting upset about over? But what is fascinating about it was that I don't really care, but the other three people who did care. Mm-hmm. We were on a train on the way back from my mother's house last week, and Conrad was sitting down, and it was a really busy train. I didn't get a seat, and I'm standing out like in the foyer. And some guy apparently had his SLR out and it would turned it and was taking pictures of Conrad from across the seat. And she got really upset about it, apparently. And she like got up and stood up and whatever it is. And like, I don't know, maybe she thought that he was taking some sort of embarrassing picture of her or something. I just find it all fascinating that it's something that people get upset about. But I guess it does inform that the people in the group, and when we discuss it, we're talking about it from the point of view of people who see these pictures all the time and make these pictures. But for the average person who doesn't, apparently they don't like it at all.
Right.
Which is very different than when William Klein, you see interviews with him, and he said back in the day, people used to try to get in front of your camera. Oh, you got a camera? What are you taking pictures of? You want to take a picture of me?
Right.
Completely different world. You know, even the stuff that what's his name? Who's the Meyerowitz, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the stuff he's doing, it's like people are, he's just walking down trying to take these candid pictures. But I think it's different nowadays than it was 30, 40 years ago. You know, more people with cameras now.
Well, and I feel like a broken record, but it comes down to intent. I don't know what your intent is in taking this picture of me.
What would be the worst case intent for you?
I don't know that there is a worst case, but number one, I don't like having my photo taken.
Right.
But number two, you know, I don't want to end up on your Instagram feed with some weird meme label or caption underneath me.
Right.
You know, it makes me very uncomfortable. Yeah. Being on camera makes me uncomfortable. You know, and it's, I think that's one of the reasons that if I am taking pictures, whether it's, you know, street work or whatever, by and large, it's architecture.
Yeah.
It's places. It's
it's things that can't complain.
Yeah. It's dumpsters, you know,
it's literally garbage is where you're taking pictures.
dumpsters. You know, I don't know. For me, there's definitely a comfort level. And I understand, I think, to the best that I can, not having been in the situation, but I understand what Conrad may have been feeling about. Look, I don't know what you're doing with it, but I just don't want you taking my photo.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, now, maybe if I knew, maybe it would be different. I don't know. Probably not, because I still don't like it, but.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, did you read this David Milner article? This it's the old way, new way thing.
Yes.
So one of our listeners sent this over to me. I forget who it was. Sorry about that. Let me go see if I can find that. Said, you know, you should read his writing. There's some really good stuff in there. And you know, I like this guy apparently walked away from photography for a while. Used to teach photography, walked away and then came back a few years later. And now has been writing, these articles and little posts on his blog, which I thought that you would actually get a kick out of just because you like reading this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But he was talking about how far more people are reading the camera reviews as are looking at pictures, you know, that these, you know, camera review posts get 600,000 views when views of some guy actually giving a good talk about work ends up getting a half dozen views or whatever it is. Right.
Right. Right. And he uses Sebastio Salgado's TED talk as an example.
Right. Which classic for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, you know, he said, people come and ask me for camera advice. And he's like, and I tell him whatever small, whatever you're willing to carry, you know, And then, you know, if they ask him about new cameras, he's like, I don't know. He's like, I probably should add, I don't care, but that might sound a tad smug. So I'm currently holding back on that little caveat. It's just, and his kind of talk is about he wears old shoes that he gets resold. He's using a Hasselblad because that's what works for him and this kind of stuff. And it kind of got me thinking about the fact that, you know, we're always trying to chase whatever the new hip thing is, right? Some people are. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes back to that Zay Frank thing from last week, which you should go read if you haven't. It's in the show notes from, I guess, episode 106. What was last week?
Seven.
107.
107.
And that's this idea of, you know, where there's the mean of whatever it is for photography, right? People are shooting with these cameras and shooting this kind of work. And then something comes along, for example, HDR.
You know, right.
10 years ago, whatever it is. So everyone started shooting HDR and it was going to be the next big thing and it's going to revolutionize the world. And I'm talking about those nasty, ugly, what we now consider nasty, ugly, super overhyped, huge halo HDR kind of things.
Right. Ironically, kind of like the shots of the shoes and the Hasselblad in this article.
Yeah. Funny enough. Right. I lost my train of thought for half a second. That ultimately it came back to the mean when everyone decided, oh, HDR is not going to be the future of photography. That was just a blip. And yeah, some people still use HDR for specific uses, but they're generally doing it really just to expand the dynamic range a little bit to do architectural stuff because they need to get the highlights in or whatever it is, right?
Right.
That it now became a tool. It is not a vision. It's not a movement, you know? And there have been a lot of things like even in like technology, 3D, right? Oh, 3D, everything's going to be 3D. Everyone needs a 3D TV. It's like, how many people do you know who actually use 3D TV at their house?
None.
Nobody.
Not one.
Like
zero.
It came and it went, you know?
Yeah.
And like
it's
lately,
the dumbest thing.
Lately in photography, the big thing has been mirrorless cameras. Everyone's going mirrorless. Now, maybe that is the future. Maybe it's not. You know what I mean? Maybe it's going to be a blip like other things. Maybe it won't. But it's like, how do you know when to follow everyone so you don't get left behind versus following everything, in which case you're just getting spun all around. You don't have any real identity of who you are.
There is one paragraph in this that I, and this will probably not be a surprise to you. There's one paragraph in this that I really clicked with.
Go ahead.
And he writes, something else dawned on me. I like old stuff. I like stuff that has been in my hands long enough to feel like it's actually mine. I like stuff I have a connection with. And he goes on to describe, I've got a friend who buys almost every new point and shoot digital camera that comes out. No joke. All brands. And he calls me and says, okay, I'm serious this time. This is the one. Then 2 weeks later, it's on eBay. And I get the follow-up call. Oh, man, that piece of crap couldn't focus and the skin tone was horrible. I'll let him finish talking and then I hang up on him. As you can see, I'm in need of new soles. And there's a photo that we just referenced of his shoes. I could buy new shoes, but I don't need new shoes. I need new soles. These shoes finally feel like they're mine. And if anyone reading this knows me, you know I wear these almost every day. This will be my third set of soles for these particular babies. When I look down, I know what I'm going to see. And more importantly, I know what I'm going to feel.
Okay. I completely understand that. And I completely agree with that as one end of the spectrum. But what about the guy who refuses to stop shooting film because, I'm going to stick with it until it's no longer available. And I'm still going to stick with it. And I'm just going to stop shooting because I hate, you know what I'm saying? Like the people who refuse to move on.
I don't know that person would stop shooting altogether when film goes away. Number two, I don't think film's going to go away completely.
I guess, but okay. Those people who refuse to do anything but the way they used to do it 20 years ago, who are just maybe just being obstinate. You know what I mean? Like, where's the line between refusing to let go and in the other direction, trying to get everything that's new because you know what I mean?
That's not for you to decide. That's for them to decide.
It's fascinating.
If Christopher Nolan wants to keep shooting film and
he is in his new movie.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, have you seen the preview?
Looks insane. Looks really good.
Can't tell if it. I said to Heather, I said, he better not mess that up.
Yeah.
and don't screw it up.
McConaughey on fire.
Oh, yeah. All right. All right. All right.
All right. All right. All right.
So you're all right with this guy.
I'm all right with this. The same, and he goes on, let me just kind of continue this for a second. The same can be said for my camera. It's the same boring model I've been using for 12 years. It's not the only camera I have, but the rest, with the exception of one, have been with me for about the same amount of time, and some much, much longer. He goes on to say, my advice to you is twofold. First, get a camera, commit to it, put all the rest in a way in a locked compartment, then give the key to a trusted companion under the promise that when you come to them in a sweaty frenzy claiming you really need those other cameras because your Superflex 5000 is only good at street photography and your Superflex 5001 is the only thing that will work for your softcore poolside glamour work with your friend, your friend will, as promised, kick you in the teeth as hard as possible, as hard as they possibly can.
Is that like the scene in Fatso where he like refuses to give him the key to get the honey out of the cabinet? You never seen that movie?
Or Young Frankenstein?
Yeah.
Whatever you do, don't open this door. I was kidding. Yeah. Secondly, use your chosen camera until it wears out, not until a new model is released or a new software version flies down from the ether. All caps, use this one camera until it wears out.
Yep.
And Preston, I hope you're listening, Preston, and I were talking about cameras, and he said something very poignant and something that resonated very, very, very deeply. He said, is there anything about your camera that's keeping you from making the pictures you want to make?
Right.
And I said, nope. He said, then you don't need a new camera.
Right.
End of story. It was just that simple. Yep. And I was like, oh, genius. You know, and I've been pretty vocal about how much I love my X-Pro, and quirks and all. There are things that it doesn't do. And there are times when I've considered doing exactly what is advocated against here and selling it and getting the new thing. But I've made the realization that I don't want to do the new thing. I don't want to be a fusion photographer, videographer, blah, 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 blah. I want to have conversations and tell stories and document that experience with still photographs.
Okay. Like it.
And that's it. So
that means you can stick with your old camera.
It means I absolutely.
You're quirks old, and all. It, old with quotes.
Yeah. Yeah. My old I'll camera tell you, that came out 2 years ago.
You know, I look, I, you know, 99% of the time I'm shooting with my Canon, and you know, I own the 5D, I own the 5D Mark II, I own the 5D Mark III, and you know, I upgrade when they come out, mostly because my old ones are getting old then and they retain their value. It's like it's a good time to flip them, you know. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Sorry, man, allergies. But, you know, the other night when I was shooting that thing, I was like, I want more than 22 megapixels for this image. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll run medium format or blah, 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 blah. And what I ended up doing was shooting a panorama and stitching it.
Ah, yeah,
sure. And I ended up with a 56 megapixel image.
Did that get you where you think you needed to be?
Yeah, I mean, there are limitations to it because it's frustrating to try to organize five people and actually shoot a panorama and not have anybody move. You know, I mean, there are reasons why it is a kludge. It's a hack.
Right.
But it's a hack that gives me a really big file in the meantime, you know? And it was interesting because it actually worked, like where there's no seams or anything like that. It's just like, it's just right. And I was like, all right, that's pretty cool. You know, that we've gotten to the point where you can do that kind of thing. But it's you know, what was my problem? Well, I wanted more pixels. Well, I figured out a way to get more pixels out of what I got.
Right.
And it works for now, you know.
Sure.
Anyway, I find this stuff fascinating because, you know, in some ways, I feel like the curmudgeon in the sense that I'm still using a big digital full frame digital SLR. And it's like, but you know what? It does exactly what I want it to do. And it fits like a glove when I pick it up and I know what it does. And I know what its quirkiness is quirks are, you know? And that, so that in itself is valuable to me as a user of that camera.
Right.
Cause now I don't have to second guess what it's doing. I don't have to worry about, I know when something looks like X on the screen that once I get it home, the raw file, I know I'll be able to pull Y back from it, you know?
Sure.
And that it's funny. It's like knowing your tools is such an important thing. like knowing the limitations of them so that you can use those limitations to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what he's getting at here. The whole idea of like, use one camera and use it till it dies.
Right.
You know, there's an argument to be made for that. Just interesting. Anyway, people should go read. I'm going to put it in here. It's called I Like Old. He's also got a bunch of other articles on here, which I think you'd get a kick out of. So you should go read some of the other ones.
Yeah, I'm going to add this to my reader.
He writes. Sometimes he sounds like an old fart, but sometimes he makes good points. Is that fair?
Yes. As any of us.
Yeah. Hey, we got a few links and stuff here. What do you got?
Well, this first one kind of goes back to what we talked about originally, and the idea of art being for the 1%, or design. This article is talking about design being primarily for the 1%, and it shouldn't be. It should be for, yeah, you know, for more.
There's nothing in the materials of half these chairs that should cost $1,000 versus $200.
Right. Now I was looking at this at the same time very close to the time that I saw this article that a Cindy Sherman photo had sold for $3 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which again, you guys know me by now. I think this is what's wrong with art.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And again, it's sort of permeating through design. You know, if you want a Mark Newson chair, it's made out of the same or, you know, similar materials than that the chair you can find at Target.
Yeah. Do you remember, I think it was, did we talk about this a while back where Restoration Hardware was making knockoffs of like Ames chairs and Navy chairs, you know, like those metal.
Yeah. The MCOs.
Do you remember when they were doing that?
Yep.
And they got busted, right? Like they sued them.
Yeah, they were too close. Yeah. You can do but something inspired by.
How old are those chairs?
MCO?
Yeah.
Well, World War II.
Right. That's not in the public domain yet?
No.
That seems weird to me. That's a long time.
Well, I think the design was patented. The manufacturing process was patented. Yeah. And then that patent was extended or purchased or absorbed.
Yeah. But at what point does something become part of the culture? I listened to an interview This Week in Law, like one of those Twit podcasts the other day.
Sure.
And they were talking about this, the whole, what's it called thing? The whole internet net neutrality stuff. Right.
Right.
And Nilay Patel was on from The Verge, and I like Nilay, and he's a attorney in a former life and a nice guy. And I generally agree with his opinions on stuff. And they had another guy on there who was arguing the whole thing from a very sort of libertarian point of view of how these companies.
Did Patel think that they should be class two?
Yes.
Common carriers.
He does.
Yeah.
And this other guy came on and said, you people have no idea what that means. And I know everything and you know nothing. And it got really, it's a fascinating thing. It's like, it got really awkward. And at the end of the discussion, Nilay was just like throws up his hands. He's like, well, you know, like, thanks. It was great talking about this. And like, you know, nice to meet you, whatever it is. And the guy was just like, I actually didn't like this at all because you're, it was like really whatever.
Wow.
And Nilay was just like, wow, you're a great guy, and hung up.
Nice.
But the reason I bring it up is that I've gotten to the point where I don't believe that business and profit are the end all be all and should be above absolutely everything else, which it feels like they are in our society.
Sure.
Like get and in the way of somebody making money and you are morally wrong.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know what? Sometimes this stuff is society owns it in some way. You know what I mean? Like that it's part of what enriches us as a people.
Yeah.
And that there's value to that. And so anyway, it's just, so yeah, I agree that we should start making, you know, some chair that was designed by some guy in 1936. You know what? You should be able to buy cheap knockoffs of it right now if they can be made for $10
a
pop.
Just, I mean, why should efficient, aesthetically pleasing, you know, well-produced goods be relegated to those people who, you know, make over. I mean, I get that there's a cost of R&D. I get there's tulip costs. I get that. But it seems like even when you know, to use the Eames chairs as an example, the Eames, especially right. the plywood chairs.
Yep.
You know, the manufacturing technique was perfected 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So the ROI has been long since, you know, achieved.
Yep.
So why are they still $700 chairs?
Right. Yeah. Sell them for 150 and you'll sell 10 times as many.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way to a large degree about art.
But there's a cachet to all of that, right?
Sure. Sort of.
People want to be known as the guy who can sell them for $1,000 or whatever.
Yeah. And you can, you know, you can Google, you know, Eames plywood chair, and there are a couple companies that do really good knockoffs.
Yeah.
I mean, they are very convincing. Do they have the Knoll label on the bottom of them or the Herman Miller label or whatever? No. But again, for me, I'm not buying that. I'd love to have an Eames chair. I'm not buying it because it was built in the Eames factory. I'm buying it because I like the look of the chair.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's frustrating. And yeah, but you know what? The example that you pull up for the Cindy Sherman.
Yeah.
Like I'm not a huge Cindy Sherman fan. Did we ever do Cindy Sherman as a photographer of the week?
I can't remember. I think so.
Okay. I mean, people are buying Cindy Sherman. That's like just people with money who want an investment, who want a thing on their wall that people recognize.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, yeah.
Or that one, they don't recognize, and then you can tell the story.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, that's Cindy Sherman. Don't you know Cindy Sherman?
Yeah. I found a boatload of money inside of my boat.
And a boatload, yeah. Literally, in that's where you're going to go?
I found $3 million in the hold of my yacht. Nice. And I said, that's a boatload of money. What should I do with it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. But I think there's two problems with your whole thing. One, yes, people should lower the price so more people could buy. And two, as a society, more people should buy art. You know? In much the same way that
Not as an investment, just because it makes you feel good.
Yeah. And you know what? Gym class, when we were kids, did not do a good job of making me want to think about my body in a way that would take care of it. You know what I'm saying?
You don't have a rope hanging in your thing.
Well, you know what I'm saying? There was nothing about phys ed that made me understand that you need to get exercise because it's good for your brain and your body. Like that,
no, it was never
that was
explained.
Not well communicated.
No, it was just go take a lap.
Right, exactly.
Or we're going to do squat thrusts or, you know.
Right. And so I think in the same way, education in this world needs to change in such a way that people appreciate aesthetics as a part of, as an important part of society, because just attaining wealth in our society for wealth's sake, we're beyond the point where we can feed and clothe and shelter everyone. What else is the point? You know?
Right. Okay.
Bigger houses, more clothes. And you know what I mean? Like there's gotta be a bigger, and I know I just said there is no value to any of this stuff, but like there's, you know, feed the eagle, you know, like live a bigger life. I don't know.
Right. Well, okay. I know this is going to, I'm going back to him again, but David Duchemin on a blog post talks about this, and he gives an interesting example. He says, look, you know, to the effect of, you can spend, you know, this much money on a camera and lenses, and he does, like, I think it's a 5D Mark III kit versus a 5D Mark II kit.
Yep.
And he says, and neither one is going to produce, you know, a horrible picture. But going with this kit, with the money that you've saved, you can buy a ticket around the world and have money left over for hotel and food and have an experience.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just kind of how you look at it.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for us to remember that at least in my opinion, we are here to experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't own my camera because it sits in the closet in a Pelican case. I own it because of the experiences that it can give me by using it.
Right.
Yep. That's the important part. That's good stuff. Hey, so I'm going to put a link to the new F&B bookshelf. Well, give me the 30-second elevator pitch. For the bookshelf.
Oh, for the bookshelf?
Yeah.
You know what? It's... it's an extension of Faded and Blurred. You know, Faded and Blurred, we tend to sort of curate interesting things that we like, or work that we want to celebrate, and things that I find. And you can find it either at fadedandblurred.com or on the new Flipboard magazine, which is very cool. There are over 300 people subscribing already. And we just put the thing up last week. And, you know, since launching Faded and Blurred, get a lot of emails asking about books, or, you know, either the books in the spotlights or for the last couple of years, the books that you and I have talked about.
Sure.
And it just made sense to
have them all in one place.
Yeah. Have them all in one place.
Yeah.
So, four categories: art, creativity, design, and photography. There are 24 titles up there right now. I'll add to it every so often. If you've got suggestions, there's an email link. You can, you know, add a suggestion, or let me know, hey, this should be there, or I'd love to see this. They are all Amazon links. So full disclosure, Faded and Blurred makes a little bit, which is nice because, you know, we've been doing this for free forever and I don't want to go to an ad model. So this will help.
Right. Go buy your books.
You know?
Through
so
here.
If you're going to buy books, and some of them are my favorites, some are on my wish list. There's some good stuff up there. I'm trying to put up things that are not just photography, and more categories may be added. I don't know.
Yeah.
But right now those four seem to fit not only what's being put up on Faded and Blurred, but what you and I talk about here.
It's a good idea. So that's bookshelf.fadedandblurred.com.
Right.
Okay.
Or there's a link in the main nav too.
Yeah.
So,
it's good. I like the idea. I read an article the other day on the time.com site talking about how the covers that they show on the Walter Mitty movie, most of them were never pictures on the covers.
I would love to have one of those big light box things of a life cover.
Yeah. Yeah, like they did? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
like
what
a
it
whole
is?
Wall.
The Life logo is so badass. The white on red on, you know, boom. It's just so impactful, you know.
Yeah. They did a good job on these.
No, they did a totally good job. It's really funny to me that those were not actually covers.
I thought that they were.
I did too until I read this. I was like, interesting. Yeah. Apparently, they all appeared in the magazine.
All the photographs appeared in Life.
Yes.
Okay.
When we were selecting photos for the Life covers, and Walter Mitty, said Jeff Mann, the production designer, we focused on pictures that would serve the story we were telling, but would also capture the diversity of what Life covered in its prime. We worked really, really hard to select photographs that were novel, naive, in the best possible way, and that featured significant 20th century people, places, or events. It's interesting. Apparently, it says the majority of the Life covers seen in Secret Life of Walter Mitty were never covers at all. The pictures on the covers in this gallery, for example, the launch of Apollo 11, James Mansfield, the swimming pool, the theater audience watching a 3D feature-length film are indisputably classic Life images, but none of them ever grace the cover. Interesting.
Yeah. You know what? I prefer the covers with the red footer, with the date and the price.
Yep.
I prefer that to just the clean covers.
Interesting.
Just as a design element. I like that anchor.
Yeah. I think they moved on. I think in the 60s they got rid of that, right? Or late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating though. Who would have thought? You know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to I'll put a link in the show notes too, because it's kind of neat to look at the ones that they had in there.
They were good.
You know what else they did really well in that movie? The scene where they... where they started sticking him in the pictures when he's running down the hall.
Yeah. And he's in like the space suit, the helmet.
Yeah. That was really cool.
Yeah.
There's things about that movie that are really great. There's a few things that I'm like, that make me roll my eyes. But then there's a lot of stuff in it that it was just like, all right, that's really cute. You know, it's a cute movie. It's a good.
The big scene I have a problem with is the whole play on Benjamin Button. That was just dumb.
Yeah. That was stupid. Yeah. You're right. Baleward, what's that guy's first name?
Alan.
That's an odd name. Alan Baleward.
Wow.
No, Alan Baleward.
You know what? Somewhere he's in a van pounding the steering wheel right now, cursing your name.
So Alan Baleward put up a review of this software that I actually thought would be interesting to everybody. I think he put it in the group, but
this is the lighting thing, right?
Yeah. Have you seen this?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's actually kind of a neat idea. I mean, at a certain point, like, why should we have to set a bunch of stuff up just to see what, and get people together and stuff just to see what something looks like? Mm-hmm. Like, you could come in here assuming, so basically it's 3D software where it'll put up a fake 3D person, and you can set up lights and then set up your camera where you want and see what the light would look like in that space.
And it's $7. I mean, it's $7. It's not a big investment.
So if they come up with, apparently, like, the types of lights and modifiers and stuff are pretty limited right now, mm-hmm. But they're adding more. At the point at which they add enough to where you could actually try out lighting ideas, setup ideas,
right?
This is actually a really cool, could be a really cool tool. If it was really good and the interface is good, I'd easily pay $20 for it, you know?
Is it a, oh, it's a Mac only thing. We
Mac
should mention
only
that.
Thing, $7. It's, I'll put a link in the show notes. It's called Photo Light Pro.
Right. And there's a demo video trailer type thing that
yeah. He, and Alan's writing his review that he says it's pretty cool that the interface is kind of like cheesy looking because it's, you know, it looks, feels very old. But the results were all right. It required more stuff. More.
It's almost modifiers. Like a. You remember Kai's power tools?
It's totally like Poser.
Yeah.
I always hated those.
It's got that sort of Kai Krause.
Oh, those drove
interface.
Me nuts. It made me want to throw stuff through a ceiling. So anyway, go check that out. Photo Light Pro. I thought that could be cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. If they would flatten the interface a little bit.
Yeah,
it would be,
because you know what, you're on a Mac. Why not use the standard Mac controls?
Yeah, well, you know,
it's not like you're even making it cross platform. You want to make some third level of stuff,
right?
I don't know. Hey, how were the Golden Hour pictures in your estimation?
Golden Hour pictures, people putting up some great stuff. That was you know, even the black and white stuff, which is hard to pull off in Golden Hour.
Yeah.
Really great work.
You know, the black and white Golden Hour, it's all about long shadows, right?
Yeah. Well, which will lead us to this week's assignment, which is shadows.
Ooh.
Shadows. Have fun with shadows. Soft shadows, hard shadows, big shadows, little shadows.
There's some good
shadows.
Stuff in your Golden Hour. Look at
there's
that.
There's some really good stuff. And people who are posting for the first time now, we should mention... We got a little shout out on Scott Kelby's blog.
We did, yeah.
Last year, last week.
This is a lot of good if it's last year.
I know, time keeps on slipping. So to those of you who are listening maybe for the first or second time, welcome. And thank you for taking the time to listen to the show. And if you are listening for the first or second time and you don't know what we're talking about, there is an On Taking Pictures Google Plus group.
Yep.
Where you can post images, have discussions. We've got 1,100 or so, 1,105 actually, yep. Members in the group. And each week for the past, I don't know, what have we been doing this for? 3 months, 4 months?
Something like that.
Yeah, we've been doing kind of weekly assignments / challenges, just a hashtag. And you have a week to go out and put something together with those hashtags. And gosh, the results are just, they're fantastic. They are really, 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 really good.
I like it when people are posting who haven't for the first time and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
It's always nice seeing...
And there's some really good work. Kristen Lamond, the shot of, I'm assuming that's your son, with a bicycle, with the skull and crossbones shirt. Great shot. Great shot.
I also like the one of the shoes on the stairs that she put up.
Yeah. Really good stuff.
Shadows, huh?
David Williams, good stuff. Sebastian Lee, he's killing it in Dubai.
Don't kill anybody in Dubai. You're going to go to jail forever. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Killing it. It. He's doing some good stuff. I'm just flipping through here. Jason Fusera, great shot of that tree. That's a big, beautiful tree. Cams Campbell, Jake.
Cams Campbell. That's
there's
a
really
name.
Cool shot of Brother Ridge. Kind of a profile shot that I think his wife took of him, but I love the mood of it.
Okay.
And I don't know. Russ. Russ Olney. Shot of a silhouette shot of a cowboy against a sunset. Love it.
Oh, I saw that one.
Good shot.
Yep.
Yeah. Really good shot. Yeah, there's just some really fantastic work. So thank you. Keep them coming. Shadows is this week.
Okay. And our photographer of the week?
Photographer this week, Larry Fink.
Interesting.
Larry Fink.
Why? Why for you? You chose this one.
Actually, this was a suggestion. This was a suggestion. So what do I like about it? I like the lighting. I like that it's this, I like seeing this guy or imagining this guy kind of wandering through the socialite scene of parties and New York and Hollywood and glamour and just kind of, you know, one of those big, one of the big Honeywell, like off camera flashes, you know, those with the big heads on them or the Sun Pack flashes or something. And just like nobody paying attention to him at all, or every once in a while shooting him a glance, like fly on the wall kind of thing.
Do you think that isn't going to be that the pictures that people take now are somehow different? The similar sort of pictures that people take are different than that?
They feel kind of different.
Okay.
And I don't know why. I tend to like work like this when people aren't mugging for the camera.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you totally. Go on and enjoy your party, you know, or just treat me as if I wasn't here and let me do my job, you know. And yeah. there are some celebs in there, people you'll recognize, Warhol.
Everyone's always having a good time in those pictures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, most of them have money.
Yeah. Right? It's easy to have a good time when you're rich. Nice.
But they remind me, a lot of them remind me of the early Avedon fashion work when he was doing the stuff in Paris, okay. In the clubs in Paris.
Sure.
You know, where we're just sort of, we're flies on the wall in this a life that's more glamorous than we will ever live.
Right. Of course, those.
Or on the right. surface.
Of course, those were... The Avedon ones were very structured and very...
Yeah. But they've got that same kind of feel or a similar kind of feel to them.
It's that whole 1950s, 60s, wow, life is grand, post-World War II, rich and fabulous, and look how wonderful life is being an American or European, or you know what I mean? It's got that sort of carefree attitude.
Mm-hmm.
That post-World War II carefree... It's funny because at the same time, it was the beginning of the Cold War, it was nuclear testing, it was, you know, segregation. There were all these things going on that had nothing to do with that view that we tend to have of those time periods in certain photographs.
Right. We have whitewashed, literally in some case, the subculture that existed then.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Well, you know, what's the adage? History is written by the winners.
Yep.
Right? And so Larry Fink been shooting for almost 50 years.
Long time
has seen a lot of changes, not only in style and aesthetics, but gear and just the business side.
Yeah.
But I think his work, if you look at his work in, you know, 50s and 60s versus now, there is a similar tone to it. And I'm not talking about, you know, black and white tone, but there's a similar aesthetic. Like he hasn't strayed much from how he has always shot.
Yeah.
Would you say that's true?
Yeah. And it's, you know, this kind of stuff is always interesting to me from the point of view of a commercial photographer, in the sense that how would you ever know what you were going to get from this guy if it's really all just about the situation? See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That it's that like every situation is different. You're just sort of grabbing what's around at the time.
I might have to buy this book. He's got a book called Social Graces.
Okay.
If it's still available. His first monograph, Social Graces, is an exploration of two different cultures, the upper crust of New York City and the down-home folk of Martin's Creek, Pennsylvania.
Well, there you go.
I bet that would be a really interesting book.
Yeah. I could have sworn.
Is it still available?
I think I know people who know this guy.
Wait, he's got a Phaedon book out too. Wow. Okay, I love me some books. Plus, you know, it's the only art I can afford.
Yeah, but you know what? Look, we talk about that all the time. You could easily buy half these books and cut prints out and put them up on the wall, and they'd be just as nice as any print you bought that was signed on the back.
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
A lot of
yeah.
these books are printed really nicely. It's funny. There are some modern ones in here.
Okay, this is still available. Look at that.
You going to go get that one?
I think I am. Social Graces, Larry Fink, $49.50. Be the first to review this item. Well, wow, when did it come out?
If it
came out in 2001, nobody's reviewed it yet? Come on.
Or maybe it's like a different, I don't know. Sometimes they like put things up differently. Yeah. I'd look around. Yeah, there's pictures of like Beyonce and stuff up here too. Interesting. Yeah, it's all of this very hyper informal stuff that he likes to try to find the thing, to try to find the composition in something that is completely unstructured. It's actually a lot like architectural street photography too, in some ways.
You know what I'm saying? Like this stuff a lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I was distracted and looking at his fine. Work. Yeah, really neat stuff. Larry Fink.
Good stuff. Anything else?
What do we got? What do you got? You have anything?
I think we're good.
Shoot us an email. Say hi.
Yep.
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
Bill is on the Twitters at Bill Wadman.
Yep.
I'm there as Jeffrey Sidoris.
Leave a voicemail. 347-687-9411.
Right.
We got a couple of them last week and it was fun.
Yeah, they're funny.
We don't play them on the air all the time, but we do enjoy.
We should play a couple of them. Let's do that next time.
Yeah, well, we get good stuff.
What else?
I think that's it.
That it?
Yeah.
Next week, you know what we want to do next week? We'll put it up in the group.
We'll put it up in the group.
All right. If you haven't joined the group, join the group. Please, 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 tell your friends about us. Okay. Even if you think they already know, shoot them an email. Say hey, buddy. Hey buddy, listen to this show.
That's what you do to me all the time, and I'm like, I'm on the show with you.
Oh right, yeah. He's like, quit emailing me.
Yeah.
I know you do the show, but you never said you'd listen. So yeah, thank you for listening. We appreciate you taking some time out of your week to have a chat with us.
Excellent. Well then, yeah, we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next week.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you want to say. So I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long. It's clear to me the way you see me is wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say. I know what you will say. Will